word to the wise. We are an explicit podcast having content with adult themes as well as entering spoiler territory if you aren't caught up with us. This week, we're just reading the short story, The Demons of Aure, from Tales of the Sun Eater, Volume 1, and likely in the future collected neither Sins or Songs of the Sun Eater. We aren't sure at this point, but if you're reading it out of that, it's in one of those two.
Yes.
Also, that means spoilers for Howling Dark, through Howling Dark, at the very least.
I don't know if I should add anything to that, but here I am saying yes, indeed.
Yes. Hey there, this is Cross.
This is Josh.
And we are Words and Whiskey, a podcast for veteran and novice readers alike. We tackle fiction novels and love to talk about what we're drinking. You should think of us as your intoxicating weekly book club. And last week we did.
Yeah, you should think of us as your concerning weekly book club. If you listen to the last two episodes at this point, I assume. The first episode, I feel like we were doing pretty good.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think second episode went mostly well until the very end. Also, I don't think it went poorly again. I do just think it went overly long and we were a little drunk. But not... There have been episodes where PJ and I have been like, we should retake the end before.
Yeah,
and I was like, I don't feel that way about this. So
I'm curious what it sounds like post edit. You know, if you tell me we got to retake the end, we got to retake the end. I remember the end. That's a good sign.
Well, and I know because I was like watching my intake. And again, we recorded that over the course of like six, almost 7 hours. And I had like three beers, the one cocktail, a little thing of whiskey, and the shot that we had at the beginning of the episode, which is like a lineup of alcohol, but over the course of 7 hours, that's not
I did the math
insane.
On the amount of time and the amount of stuff I drank, and I was like, it made sense that I didn't have a hangover the next day. So
I had to wake up earlier, so I didn't get quite as much sleep, and that was really the biggest thing. No hangover, but a lack of sleep did kind of like
is basically the same as a hangover post 30. You know,
yeah, exactly.
I can not drink at all for a week, get 4 hours of sleep, and be like,
and that's really what it felt like. But overall, I hope y'all enjoyed that one and the multiple devil's cuts that came out of that episode, including. I don't think any of it will make it to the edit because it's way too spoilery, and I believe that it will entirely be cut out. But a whole conversation
at a certain point,
about
we just abandon the spoiler.
An entire conversation about Tactus and Roke from the Red Rising series, which is very fun. So enjoy that. But that said, we're here today to talk about a very different beast in a lot of ways, and it's not really a beast; it's more like a little treat, a little taste between
there's
books.
There's a beast in it, you know?
Yeah, true. Yeah. The Demons of Aure by Christopher Rocchio, sort of the first short story that we've covered on the show. And we're going to cover a couple, I've decided.
Because we covered a novella, but that's not really a short story. That's a novella. You know?
Yeah, and next week we're going to cover Queen Amid Ashes as well. So, you know, there's that. And I realize we're talking about this as though this is coming out sooner than it is, because actually our wrap-up has also already came out by the time that this comes out.
I made a lot of really good points.
I think I made some good jokes. Yeah.
I think
Nick was great.
Nick, I can't believe Nick said that.
Dude, it's so cool because we've been talking and trying to get Nick on the show. Not really trying, but like we've been talking about Nick being on the show for 5 years, and it was so great to have him.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it was definitely great to
hopefully that works out and we don't have to cancel for some reason, because that would be crazy.
Certainly, as of right now, we have had Nick.
Yes.
On the podcast, biblically.
To kick it off, talking about Demons of Aure, I'd love to get just again your sort of like general vibes and how you feel about this little short story.
It's so sick that Hadrian killed the one and only Sealted, I'm going to call him.
Because
that would suck if more of those existed. That would be a really big problem. So
could be
cool
a really
we
big
got rid
problem.
Of the one.
The one. The failure,
yeah,
as
no,
it's
this was,
titled.
I mean, it definitely, like, not to be as the joke I make sometimes, but the guy who's read... the guy who's only ever read The Lesser Devil being like, yeah, it had real Lesser Devil vibes. But like, you know, it definitely reminded me of the way how Christopher like dove more into the action of it all and made it more like a classic sci-fi action film feel than maybe he does in kind of the broader, more melodramatic, more poetic, more ponderous main series. It was interesting to get a first person story from Hadrian that wasn't being told from Hadrian in the same way. It was just a classic, like, this. It was first person, but it was first person, like, just a book, not like a retelling from the future.
Yeah, it still has some of those notes, but where it has them, it's very specific to basically be like,
it never really references the future. Yeah, exactly. Unlike how we are, where it'll reference that, like, hey, I know what comes next. It was very much so Hadrian only seemed to know what we know and back, you know. And also like, this should play as the, like, if this ever gets made into a TV show, this should just be the season 3, like, previously on Sun Eater, because they recap almost every major point.
part of me thinks that this is kind of just lopped. These were like the first chapters that maybe he wrote of Demon in White. Not to, I mean, you've not touched that yet and won't for like another week or two. But
yeah,
it feels as though these are maybe, and I'll be curious to see what you think once we start that, if these were like lopped off or intended, or if they just kind of feel that way because it's a cool story. And he wanted to also be able to get people introduced into the story in a unique way. To just kind of circle back a little bit on this idea, like, it's a curious question to think of whether or not this was like intentionally lopped off, or if this was, again, like most of the short stories are, just meant to be like an introduction to Hadrian Marlowe. What if this is the first time that you're seeing this story published somewhere, you know?
I did keep thinking about while I was reading it, like, a person could almost pick this up, almost, with like, not having read the series. This could be someone's introduction to the story. Almost. You know, almost. Like, there's a few things where I'm like, I don't know if we really describe Psalms or C. Elson enough for it to make sense. But, like, outside of that, someone
although
could pick this
Psalms,
up.
Psalms, they got, like, the armless thing. Like, there's a little bit. The C. Elson, maybe, like, not so much, but
I think we definitely get, like, an idea, but, like, we should describe a little bit more on those, and then this could seriously be, like, the thing I hand to a friend who's on the fence and be like, hey, check this out. If you like this, jump in. That's where it goes. You know, there are also spoilers for the first two books in their entirety.
I mean, it doesn't quite get into like the Karn of it all necessarily, but it does reference Brethren pretty directly, and it does obviously talk about Vorgosos.
It references everything, but it doesn't really spoil everything, which is where I was like, this could be a fun intro, like, to the series.
It does say that he kills the prince. There's a certain point that comes up,
but I feel like he gives us spoilers like that in the main series anyways. We just don't know what it means till we get there.
Right Yeah, you know, very true.
It's not that different than knowing that the light of that murdered son, Ghadonin.
maybe there's a good pitch there to be like, if you were on
did
the
he
fence
not say
after
he's
the
patricidal
first book.
Like
yeah, very true. Very true. I'm just saying, like, if you're on the fence after the first book, maybe you could hand this to someone and be like, hey, I know you don't want to commit to the whole book.
And then they're like, oh, Emesh. Oh, I know about C. Elson. They don't know about Psalms yet, but, you know, they'll figure it out.
Yeah.
So you could maybe
get introduced to that concept.
And it would be really interesting going into this, knowing that it takes place after the second book, but reading it before the first one, jumping into that first scene from the second book.
With those Psalms, first couple of chapters,
those first introduction to Psalms,
absolutely.
Damn, it would be so cool, and I don't know, I'll have to finish the series, but to go back and re-edit this entire series, including the short stories and stuff, out of order. You know, kind of jumping around, kind of like you know, in the movie version of Watchmen, where he becomes Big Blue Dick and he experiences time out of order, and we're just kind of experiencing it with him as we're remembering things from different dates and different orders. Be a wild way to hear the story.
That would be a wild way to hear the story, and we kind of, like, in some ways that in is sort of the way do. That's this is presented a little bit, you know, but with more of it in context, that'd be interesting. Cool. All right. Well, because this is going to be a shorter episode, we're imagining, for a number of reasons, including the content here, we're going to kick it off with our cocktails because we think that makes sense. I mean, we're already in the episode, but let's talk about the cocktails now. Josh, what have you made?
Went super simple, which is kind of a pun, because the whole reason I made this one is because I still had more of that simple from the last one.
Mm-hmm.
That was the lemon, pepper, and herb simple syrup that I made.
Mm. It's very tasty. Yeah, right.
I've been using it for my cooking. I used it in like an Alfredo sauce I made last night to drizzle over like a pink sauce pasta with like lemon ricotta, whipped dollops, and Brussels sprouts and shrimp and stuff. And it was just like crazy good.
That sounds ridiculous. Yeah.
Yeah, I do be cooking. I be doing cooking sometimes.
Nice.
All the times. Most nights. But oh no. I named myself Josh Horse. Oh, that's be the horse, but you know, whatever. God, I never came up with a name for this, but it's just an old fashioned. I mean, at the end of the day,
yeah.
It's an old fashioned with scotch instead of bourbon or rye. But it's 2 ounces of scotch, 2 ounces of scotch, 1/2 ounce of my lemon pepper simple with fresh herbs, and then 5 shakes of Angostura because I wanted it more bitters, and then with a lemon twist instead of orange peel, because I think we just got to stick with the lemon at that point, you know?
Yeah, I love that idea. That sounds super tasty.
I'm calling it, even though I like it, the failure.
Nice.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. The cocktail that I made is kind of similar. I was like, I'm just going to make something old fashioned adjacent. Then I was looking and I was like, okay, I can do this with scotch, which I settled against doing because I was like, wait a minute. I just bought this new allspice dram and I want to like play around with it a little bit more. What if we made like an allspice dram style scotch cocktail?
Nice.
So it's almost more like a spin that's more adjacent to almost an improved whiskey cocktail, but it is sort of, I don't know. So what it amounts to is 1 ounce of allspice dram, 1.5 ounces of vodka, the Haku vodka, really clean drinking vodka.
Ooh, I love
is
that.
What you want. And then 1 bar spoon of green chartreuse, 1 bar spoon of simple syrup, spritz of absinthe stirred on a rock. The only thing I'd add, I didn't have any fresh fruit, otherwise I would have done an expression of lemon, orange, something in that range.
Yeah, a little citrus pop on there.
Just a little bit and it would be perfect. But this is actually so good. I'm so pleased.
Okay, the problem is every time I make an old-fashioned variant where I just get fancy on the simple or something, like, it's better. Better than all the ones where I try and go crazy with it.
Yeah.
Old-fashioned variants, they're always the best.
Yeah, and this is somewhere between an old-fashioned and an improved whiskey because of that chartreuse kind of rounding it out. And the allspice dram being sweeter, which is similar to the maraschino. So it's like, it's somewhere in the middle.
Almost an improved. Yeah.
Yeah. Just because of the full profile. But it's like exactly what I want. And I'm probably going to use this hack to make like a shortcut improved cocktail.
Nice.
So I think that's the move now.
Well, cheers on both of us having very like classic old school cocktails with a modern twist.
Yeah. Cheers. Clink.
They're just good.
Mm-hmm. Delightful. I did grab a Juicy Haze IPA just in case I wanted it, but
I'm drinking water. So.
See, that would have been a great idea. It's across the room now, so much more reasonable.
I drank my one non-liquor drink while I was doing the reading before we jumped on here.
That's fair. So
it was a White Claw. It's what I had. Payday could not come soon enough.
These White Claws, they're just doing it. Cool. All right. Well, with that, let's get into the story here. This breaks itself up into 3 chapters that we'll talk about pretty cleanly. I don't have a whole lot of structure necessarily, so, you know, we'll kind of freeform talk about it. But The Mouth of Hell is such a kick-ass chapter. I think that this is actually, to date, my favorite action sequence that we get in the whole series.
It's so good. It's also very it keeps a nice balance of like in the moment and also like tactical overview, I think, which is like really cool if you're into like
4X strategy. Yeah.
Yeah.
RTS.
Look,
yeah.
It's okay to have your own personal thoughts and feelings about certain things. And also just get really swept up in the hoorah of it all, right? You know, because that I'm like, hey, you know, this is a fantasy world. Yeah, fucking yeah, military. I love it.
Well, and obviously, like the immediate reference to the cocktail, right, and your name and this the horse, like the giant. Yeah. Beast,
oh my god,
this war machine.
Immediately,
right?
All I could think of was the Scarab in Halo 2.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, that's totally what it's
Which is like,
at.
That's my favorite level in probably all of Halo, is like the, I guess it's like three levels that center around that. But everything, right, like, centered around the Scarab and taking it down and everything. Oh my god. I was so pumped. And it felt so Halo, but also very 4X strategy, but also, a little tower defensey, you know.
yeah, you get the flybys of the different ships as well that are dropping the bombs. You get the SOMs, which are horrific in this case.
That moment where he's like, "Hey, like infantry to the front," and they're like, "What?" And he's like, "Well, we need bayonets," and they're like, "Oh yeah,
we're doing stabbings."
Oh, we're stabbing them. All right, sign me up, coach. Yeah, exactly.
And switching up the strategy that way is really, really interesting. As the hoplites kind of move forward, but the SOMs again, like the visual on this is crazy, especially as we know that this is like, what, 2,200 SOMs that we're fighting here? So the scale is just huge immediately. And they're running forward. They don't have arms. They're just biting and chomping and crazy shit.
It's like if the Flood went to a rave first.
Yeah. Or zombies, like, you know. I mean,
it's very World War Z in the way I was describing them. Like, one will get stabbed, but the rest will, like, just vault over.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Like, these are fast zombies, which are the worst kind. I think we can all agree.
Yeah.
The kind I would least like to experience.
The scariest kind. Yes.
Yes.
Right. Right. The ones that like do not care about their muscle tissue and will absolutely run you down. I mean, this is just an epic chapter. We're also introduced to a new character that's added to our entourage immediately here in the form of Lorian Aristides. We don't get a whole lot on him immediately, but do you have some early thoughts?
Yeah, this is also an interesting thing where probably this character shows up in other books, but this is my first time getting a character I don't have an audiobook
voice to associate.
Knowing how to say their
name. Interesting. Yeah.
I was thinking Aristides, you know, but Aristides.
Aristides.
Not Aristides.
Yeah.
It's crazy. Mm-hmm. I'd have gone Aristides, but I don't know much about Lorian.
Yeah, right.
But pretty cool. I know that Lorian is one of the people that Hadrian like mentions being jealous of their bird's eye view and stuff. So this is someone who's like kind of commanding more upper level with the air support, and I assume we will get more of that later. It's also just really wild and cool to see kind of like, I assume this is not that far in the future from book two, who Hadrian kind of becomes with this new knighthood, this like general Hadrian, this Hadrian who's like, I'm not a soldier, I'm a poet. No, this is Hadrian the soldier.
Yeah.
And it's very like, it's also interesting to see the switch up. Like he's suddenly kind of an empire boy.
Yeah. Yeah. He's much more of an empire boy. It goes to show that he was almost never not an empire boy. He was just so anti-Chantry that, you know, it like really, really was messing with him.
Yeah. Kind of a barbarian at this point.
Yeah.
Which also, Valka's not around, you know?
No Valka in this, yeah.
No Valka in this. I mean, not necessarily that should be like on the ground anyways, but like at the end of the last book, Hadrian was like, come with me anyways. I don't know where Valka is. I don't know if she's there. I don't know if she's not. Hadrian seems to be big into soldiering for the Empire. Very like praise the sun about it also. But it's the Earth, I think.
Earth. Right.
So, yeah, it's interesting to see the change up in Hadrian. And there's even kind of later, like a mention to why that change up might be. I think Hadrian is really aspiring to be the version of himself he saw at the end of Howling Dark in the Howling Dark. And like, it's interesting seeing him like change up so much on who he's been and stop resisting like this Empire soldier conqueror hero version of himself to be some scholar, to be like, nah, I'm gonna be that guy, you know. It's very fun to see.
Yeah. In addition, another like cool aspect of this whole story that kind of interweaves itself is we get a lot more like Polinos to Ron, like directly on the battlefield too, which is great.
Yeah, I love seeing Polino on the battlefield. Sauron, I feel like I maybe on a second read that's someone who stands out more, but like that's a name I know. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure
Sirin,
Polino's like significant other. Is that person?
Alara is.
Okay. Yeah. I was like, I don't know who Sauron is. I know I've seen that name.
Sauron was with Gen and was like a big partner, but was also in a lot of the same scenes.
Hey, look, there's two big beefy Myrmidon dudes, and they both had girlfriends at some point. Neither of those girlfriends got a lot of characterization, so I do get them a little confused.
Sauron wasn't necessarily a girlfriend, but was like with, like was was just like course. They were paired in that way. I don't think that there was anything romantic between them necessarily.
Is that not the person that Hadrian had to like tell that Gen died?
She did, but that's because they were friends and that they were really close.
Which maybe implies
a romantic implication, but that's never something that I've fully read into that. But hey,
you know, I've actually read the whole thing once.
That's cool.
So far up to that's this cool. point. So yeah. I feel like I know what I'm talking about.
Very, very fair. To kind of round out this chapter, we end with sort of this reveal of this tattoo on the shoulder of one of these guys, and that this is the Lost Legion here that we're finding at this extra Solarian pirate base.
Such a good reveal, since we were looking for the Lost Legion. Like, that's why we're here in the first place, kind of, to a degree. Very fun to have that, like, I think I know what happened to our Legion moment. One more thing to mention from this chapter. Just a moment that stood out to me was whenever Hadrian does kind of like duck over, whenever Somm jumps out at him as he holds the sword up, you started making a face and I was like, he hates what I'm saying. No, he holds the sword up and he kind of allows the Somm to cut itself in half. And it like causes like a spatter of blood and like a milky white fluid to get on his cloak. Like his cape specifically, like his black and red cape. And there's a moment where he kind of stops the description short of everything else going on in this like intense battle and takes a moment to like mention that he's disgusted by it and brush it off of his nice cape. And I just think that's such like a prissy Hadrian moment. And I love it. Like in the middle of battle, he's like, get it off of my nice clothes. That one stood out to me for some reason, and I thought it was fun. That, like, at the end of the day, like, he's becoming Darth Vader. But, like,
this is a lot more Anakin-coded,
He'll still stop to brush off his cape.
I find that to also be, like, a trait that I think that, like, Anakin has, right? Is sort of like a sort of, like, brushing off, like, sort of arrogance, right?
Of course.
That's there, too. But, yeah, either way, like, I'm totally with you. He's definitely going to clean his cape.
Yeah, it's so funny that, like, we stop dead center of the battle. Like, he doesn't tell us about like anything after the bombs start dropping, but he does stop to tell us about how he made sure his cloak stayed clean.
Really, really shows us the type of man that he is.
Yeah.
All right, cool. Well, with that, I think we can move into the captain, our second chapter here. We open with this idea of the experience of Orgosos very much still being there in Hadrian's mind. We get some of the different flashbacks. And again, kind of like you said, this works as sort of like a nice little summary catch up if you really wanted to have that or like felt the need to have that between books. Or again, sort of as our pseudo introduction, like we mentioned. We get this like look at the fortress, and eventually we come to the surrendered captain of the Free Company that occupied this place. What's his name? Faber?
Something Faber.
I forget what his first name is. It was kind of interesting.
I can grab it.
Tis somewhere in here.
Got it right here. Any second now. Right here. Yep. Pulling it up.
Right.
For sure. Got it right here. Any second now.
Samuel.
Damn it. I was trying to beat you to it. You just keep saying Faber. Stop saying Faber. Give me the name.
Samuel Faber. Captain of the Dardanines. which I don't know if it stands for anything in particular. The closest thing that I could find is maybe an assumption that it's like a shorthand for there's like a canal that runs near Turkey that joins a couple of
a lot of Turkish stuff going on.
Well, yeah, he's said it's a clear inspiration. So maybe that's the case in this case. I don't know. That seems like maybe a stretch even, but.
It's probably Dunedain, but he was like, I can't do that. So he changed the letter.
You know, it is kind of adjacent to Dunedain. You're right.
Yeah.
That's cool. But we kind of get the like explanation of the job here, right? And his sort of like begging for, you know, his crew to be, you know, let go and freed.
Yeah.
It's a very like kind of a frightening chapter in the way that it's written. Like he's creating some dread here for us.
Oh, very much. He's like, hey, they're going to be here any moment now. And I love the, like, he's talking, there's like definitely the sense of like, who are you so afraid of? And then we get it. And it's like, they're going to be here any moment now. And everyone else is like, in years. And Adrian's like, hours. Like, you guys don't know what I saw in Forgosos. And that's like so much of this chapter is just, you guys don't know what I saw in Forgosos. Mm-hmm. I also think it's interesting that Hadrian approaches this questioning much more imperial than he's approached these things in the past. Like, there's definitely a threat of torture that he's implying. We're not even really implying, just willing to carry through here, that maybe he wasn't previously somebody who would be okay with that in almost any situation in, you know, the first book. Maybe the second.
Yeah, this is almost very, very clearly more of a war situation in every context, right? Like, this man has led to, like, the death of thousands, 20,000-ish men 20,000, plus, you know? So I think that he's probably pretty fed up with it and is like, hey, man, one life, I don't give a shit. But that is still different than how he feels, you know, especially in Empire of Silence, where he's like, well, one life could make the difference. And now he's like, nah, man, that guy's life is forfeit.
Yeah, definitely. Also, like, I don't know. I feel like Hadrian has always kind of had a weird thing where he's more willing to give, like, humanity to the Sea Elsin than he is to the Extrasolarians, which is interesting.
Also true. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, we meet Faber. We meet Faber, and he's scared out of his mind and just wants to save his crew. And it does kind of like beg the question of like, how different is this Faber from like the people that Adrian brought into the Red Company? Just circumstances changed and jobs were different, and now they're trying to do the best they can.
Right.
How different is Faber's situation now to like Hadrian on Forgosos? You know, like, this is still like just a company of mercenaries that found themselves kind of stuck and now dealing with Extrasolarians. How different is what we're looking at this person from what Switch thought was going on? You know, like, this is just a person who got stuck with extras and then took a job and then through hubris or whatever ended up where they couldn't get out and were afraid. Hadrian was like right there a year ago. You know, like, I don't know how long ago, but like, it's interesting. Like, I do kind of find Faber almost like a strange mirror to like Hadrian from Howling Dark in a different circumstance.
Yeah, I mean, especially considering the Federati angle, like you're saying, exactly. Right? So like, they were just a bad job away. You know, if Hadrian would have split, for instance, from being in this exact same situation, who's to say, right?
Yeah. Like, if Hadrian like found a way to bounce and they were all just left on Forgosos, is this what they would have ended up doing? Like, maybe. In exchange for not being turned into Psalms, well, we'll get you Psalms. It's not that big of a stretch.
Not unreasonable. And I think that especially you drawing that comparison to Switch and sort of like his fears makes a lot of like logical sense here.
Yeah.
This is what Switch was afraid of.
But then, yes, which I mean, oh, now I get Switch. No, like, I've been on kind of Team Switch this whole time.
No, right. You have been. And I agree with that, for the record. I'm not saying that either way, but.
Yeah. But it's really interesting to get this, like, threat of the incoming Minos.
Yeah, this new group, right? Named after the Minoan king, responsible for the whole Theseus and the Minotaur bit, which again feeds back into this larger idea and metaphor that we're beginning to see Hadrian for as well, as a Theseus of sorts, perhaps. It's interesting.
I love that he's like, Theseus, and we're back. Like, Hadrian definitely just kind of views himself as a Theseus at this point, mm-hmm. to some degree, you know, every time Theseus can be brought up, Theseus does get brought up.
Well, he even looked back at his, like, death a little bit and, like, meeting the quiet lovingly in that reflection, you know, yeah. that in with, like, a strange smirk, I think, is how it's described or something similar.
Yeah,
to that.
Yeah. And there's definitely just this thing where I think this is the chapter where he, like, recalls that version of himself. And he's like, you don't know who the fuck I will be. Mm-hmm. Not who the fuck I am, but, like, who the fuck I will be, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that this is definitely, it's so weird. It's like if you showed Walter White in season one, like season seven Heisenberg, like mm-hmm. you didn't show him the end. You didn't show him how bad it gets, but like, you know, you're just like, look how cool you'll be. And he's like, yeah. And so like this whole thing is like Hadrian existing with an idea of like the fucked up badass villain he'll be later. And he's like aspiring to it, which is interesting. It's very interesting. And it kind of shifts his entire like character in a way that isn't like outside of what his character would do. It makes so much sense seeing that he would be like, I have found my purpose. It's to be that scary motherfucker. Mm-hmm. But it does change who Hadrian is very deeply. We get to see that. It's fun.
Yeah. I honestly, like, part of me believes that there's some universe in which Christopher wrote these books, and book one and book two are combined, compound into one book.
Yeah, compounded it.
Most of it is shortened, obviously, and like we get still like the Colosseum and stuff like that, but then we end up on Vorgosos in the back half, right, of that first novel, and then
almost
we're like,
makes a little more sense as a story, but there's just so much information that I feel
right
like
oh absolutely yeah. right it's all incredibly relevant, but it does feel like those two books are pretty directly paired. Like
I would not be surprised to find that on like an early outline that was one book mm-hmm. story.
What's unique about that too is we also have The Murdered Son, which is the first draft of the original book, which we will be reading at the very end of the series as a one shot episode. But just to kind of like talk about the origins therein and some thoughts around it. But yeah, I mean, that said, back to this chapter just a little bit. We get this idea. We get some Legion intelligence. We get a little bit more of the flashy military stuff. As we discuss, Siren's kind of there and around. They talk about this sort of like scary Crete Minos designing the Psalms. And yeah, anything else before moving into our final chapter?
Nothing that immediately stands out to me. I mean, I really like the suspense that's built here with Minos. Mm-hmm. It almost gives like, it's sci-fi, but it almost gives like, I don't know, there's a vibe to it that's like classic, like almost espionage action movies.
Mm-hmm.
Where you're like James Bondy, where it's like you finally learn the name of the villain and you're like, he's coming, you know, and it just builds that up in such a cool way. It's
totally well written in that way where it like really leads you in. And I think that there's some of that is this intentionality of this being three chapters, you know, act one, act two, act three, right? Like this is just clean structure, you know?
Yeah, this is such a outline. Much like The Lesser Devil, this weirdly could be turned into a movie. You know?
Yeah, I mean, this is a perfect single episode of a TV show.
Yes,
or like a,
exactly.
You know, like
a perfect Doctor Who episode.
Yeah, exactly. So absolutely great. With that, we'll move into the Living Failures.
Ooh, a great Black Mirror, actually.
You could strip the IP out of it and make it a Black Mirror episode.
Probably a solid Love, Death, and Then Robots, for sure.
This is absolutely a Love, Death, Robots episode.
Yeah. Most accurately, I think, out of those three.
Mm-hmm. That said, Living Failures. Plino and crew find a total of roughly 7,400 remaining soldiers in Fugue. This is where we kind of get our rough estimation of the number of Psalms that were out there fighting. They signal back to Lorien on the Tamerlane, which is seemingly a capital ship. We don't get more details there. But Hadrian then proceeds to cut his way into the next bay room with Saran over his shoulder, kind of attending. So, fun little thing here as we wander into the next room.
There's a lot here that interests me.
Mm-hmm. I did have a quote that I pulled. So the one quote that I pulled from this is a fun one.
Yes.
This is basically as Captain, he says, like, Captain Faber had said that the Mino staff had fled the base when we attacked. That had been a lie. We would have noticed any ship attempting to leave RA when our assault began. There had been none. So that's sort of our context as we walk into this. The Magi teach us before the first cause in the cataclysm that birthed the universe, there was only dark, and that it was from that darkness, the infinite chaos and potential that exists in the absence of light, that anything might happen. And so everything had happened, and the universe had emerged, birthed not as the ancient pagans would have it, by the declaration of a deity, but born of the limitless chaos that comes in the absence of light. That is why we fear the dark, not for what it contains, but for the threat that it might contain anything.
It's so good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The threat that it might contain anything. Mm-hmm. I think it very, like, well expresses the fear of the dark, because it really is just that your imagination is so much worse than anything out there. And now everything in your imagination is out there until proven otherwise.
Well, exactly. And Christopher, when he does these best, when he goes on these like little tangents, he gives you that little punctuation. And then it's like, and so this is the feeling that we have going into this moment, right?
Yeah.
Is this sort of like fear of what comes next. And it kind of goes to show that like he's done such a good job, especially in this last book, of going from, you know, the first book was mostly, I don't know if I could like nail down a thematic sort of tone for a lot of it. But the second book has a distinct horror, like sci-fi tone.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, definitely.
And this mirrors that with a little military hoorah, but little aliens. Yeah, you know?
It's interesting. I'd say the first book almost has like a historical, like fictional biography. Like,
sure.
Like a
gladiator, or like, what are we, where are we going?
Yeah, kind of gladiator, but like almost like a fictional retelling of a real life of somebody.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
I'm trying to think of the word for that. biopic.
Yeah.
Biopic.
Yeah.
It almost has like a historical biopic vibe.
Mm-hmm.
Where like stuff's just kind of happening. It doesn't follow a traditional story arc because it's just an actual person's life. Like it feels like someone made a movie and's like, this is Alexander. You know, like, which has been done.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Or like a Amadeus vibes.
That's exactly what I was just thinking. I was like, I'm not gonna interrupt him, but I was
it
like Amadeus
kind of feels like Amadeus if I were to like put it in a tone. But yeah, Howling Dark is inherently horror.
Mm-hmm.
It's like sci-fi horror, expanse horror, like infinite blackness horror and body horror all at the same time.
And this sort of shares those vibes, you know, to some degree.
Yeah.
You know, there's the fear of the dark, the fear of what's ahead of us, but it also shifts into this militaristic science fiction too.
I was going to say,
which is where I say aliens, right? Like,
I don't know what the third book is like, but this feels like the tonal shift from horror to military in a alien to aliens kind of a way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. We'll see. You still have Queen Amid Ashes to read before we get to the third book.
Hey, you know, what could she possibly have to say about it?
Hey, and you know, the fun part about that is I've already told you a little note about that book, but
yeah,
a little bit more of a kind of this style story. So.
I'm excited.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, again, love that little quote as we begin to kind of head our way down. We've got this fear of like, well, they have to be down there. Let's chase them down there. Dark room filled with bodies. We cut it in, you know, with our sword, of course, very like deep, dark Star Wars space. The little, I can imagine the fog with the blue lights, you know, kind of like illuminating the ground. You know, we get kind of that whole feeling here. And we see one move, and so then the camera shifts, you know, real quick.
Yeah, exactly. Or we don't even see it move.
Mm-hmm.
It's just the shot goes off, and it's like, I thought it moved. Mm-hmm. We don't know if it moved or not, right? Like,
yeah. We think one moves, yeah. But then we find all these different bodies that are spread out in front of these terminals, right? And then one starts talking to us more, fleeing, and telling us more about this Minos operation.
Oh, man, this idea that they're like, hey, they're dead, and Hadrian's able to, like, suss out, like, well, kind of. They're not dead. They're cooling down because they all just uploaded themselves to the fucking cloud.
Mm-hmm.
Like, which is a really interesting thing for me within the story context, within like the greater universe, Because I felt like Karn was the only one who could do that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really interesting that there's more people with the ability. I thought that was Karn's big trick. That's how Karn was Karn. It's that Karn was the one guy who could like upload, re-download into new bodies in that way. So I'm super curious what's going on with Minos. Like, it almost makes me think, like, is Minos like an offshoot of Karn? Or is Minos something that like grew from Karn? Like, is Karn involved at all? Because it would be wild if Karn wasn't. The Lord of Vorgosos, the Undying, these people are also theoretically undying, unless there's like a part of the uploading and downloading consciousness into new bodies that they haven't figured out, where like their mind still decays, that Karn has. I don't know. There's something there that like has me confused of like, okay, why is Karn so mythical, so special if other people can do this, you know?
There is a line here too, wherein the doctor, of whom is our Minos person that we're talking to here, references that Hadrian made Karn bend to him, which is unique.
Yeah. So it's like they're not Karn, but they're like, they know
friendly to Karn. Yeah.
Either. And they've certainly had dealings with Karn. Mm-hmm. Or not dealings, but run-ins, maybe?
Yeah, maybe a little bit of both over the years. You know, who knows? Yeah.
There's this really interesting thing that just like it makes me wonder, like, what is Karn to them? Who are they to Karn? They're clearly not like completely separate being. Or, I mean, not like they're the same person, but like their stories are interwoven in some way, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they say thousands of years, though, so not the same degree of time, right? Or perhaps right. Lifespan within this section. But like, we don't get that much more information. It's more of this is a lingering question. This is an introduction of a question. You know,
yeah, it almost makes me feel like maybe Karn wasn't so protective with this technology in the beginning and then became mm-hmm. more selective later on after he made some Minos that weren't necessarily a servant of the way. I don't know. I feel like there's a connection here, a question and a connection.
Yeah. It begs for answers.
Or did, like, we still don't know how Karn even got that technology in the first place. Did he develop it, or was that given to him by Brethren? Was this given to them by a demon? You know, like.
It's tough to say. Yeah. A lot of questions.
Tough to say.
No answers.
I feel like you have answers.
No answers quite yet.
Cool. So there's like more than one Mirakani Eye demon still alive out there?
Well, I mean, like, there's got to be at least the one.
But more than one?
Well, like, the Mirakani Eye demon is composed of many little demons, you know, like, because they're
and
all
there's
the
also
a
completely
hands.
Separate one.
There's also or a completely two. Separate one or two?
Maybe three. Who's to say?
Who's to say? Who's really to say? Could there be hundreds? Are the Cielsin actually Mirakani Eye demons?
Oh, now you're making me hurt my brain. No, I don't think so.
Nah, yeah, right.
Created by, though.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That said, they do, like, temporarily kind of take down this woman, but then she quickly gets away as a part of that. Like, she gets shot, right? But then she turns off her nervous response, I think is what Hadrian keys into. Saran then heads off after her, and as a result, Hadrian is left to kind of wander around in this dark cave, and one of these living failures awakes and begins to fight and swing at him.
I love, well, so there's this moment where, like, Hadrian's looking for this doctor, and... Mm-hmm. The doctor gets shot and Hadrian's like, we got her. And then she just starts talking in his own like speakers within his helmet.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, so like consciousness just leaves broken body, goes into Hadrian's. Like, it's so cool. These are like these Minos is pretty fucking cool. I it's such a sick like biological cyborg
ghost.
Cloud space ghost. Thing that just exists. I mean it almost feels anime villain-ish and like the way that like some demons operate in some animes, you know, where it's like inhabiting bodies but leaving them as spirits and then like not that it's like completely unique to that, but just the way how it plays in this scene feels like it could be straight out of like Demon Slayer, you know.
That's part of the reason that I draw that comparison to like a ghost, because in a lot of ways it reminds me of like in a fantasy story, instead, this would be like you kill the lich, but the lich's soul remains and maybe talks to you because you haven't broken the phylactery, you know?
fucking nerd.
Yeah.
But right. Yeah, no, 100%. This is some phylactery shit. You haven't gotten the Dremels in the right spots on Vecna yet.
Yeah. Upcoming TV show.
talking about a certain show that's not out yet.
It's going to take two seasons to get there, but it'll be
exciting. I have to assume. It's already been official. Okay. Yeah. I just don't think they're going to do the Dremels because that was the most like Matt had to make them go do something thing ever.
Yeah,
well, that's a critical role conversation we're having here for the uninitiated.
And if you haven't watched The Legend of Vox Machina, you should, because it's great. Great fantasy.
Should. It's so good. And I would say I don't know. Maybe people would get mad at me or whatever. But like so far, there's only one season. I just think the Mighty Nein is better.
I mean, I am prone to agree because it is not only it's my preferred of the campaigns that I've completed.
But as a show, I just find it better.
I would agree, but I do think it's better for people to get their introduction taste from the first couple of episodes of Legend of Vox Machina.
Get into Legend of Vox Machina, watch the whole thing. Whenever I say it's better, it's like maybe I prefer Avatar The Last Airbender to Legend of Korra, but I still really fucking like Legend of Korra.
Same. Yeah. I'm on the other side of that coin. I prefer Korra, but
I think Korra season one might be my favorite season of Avatar or Korra. I just think season one is so fucking perfect. And then I think that Korra is like great continuing, but uneven. Whereas Avatar is like a nice kind of steady climb. Like Avatar season one, great Nickelodeon show. Season two, whoa, what are we doing? This is crazy. Season three is like peak, you know, like it just gets better. Whereas Korra's like a little up and down even throughout
and
the
that's
seasons.
For production reasons and other things like that.
It's not their fault.
Yeah. My thing with Korra, and this is just the quickest aside to wrap up this thought, is I really love Korra in particular because the ideas are all there and you can tell that they really just got hemmed in by corporate decision making more than anything else. So I mean,
so
hats
much
off
shit
for like
against
such a
Korra
great idea
from the studio, and hats off on them and like finding a way to finish it still.
Yeah.
Like, you're canceled. Okay, what if we did a web series? You know?
Right.
Okay, you're back. Okay, well, what do we do? You know?
Like, yeah. All of a sudden.
The constant back and forth. But yeah, so it's impressive. It's a show of resilience. Can't wait for the movie that's coming out right now. For
very,
Avatar.
Very true. Very exciting.
All right. Back to Living Failures, though. Because something to be coming out of the Nickelodeon pipeline here.
It's true. Out of this Nickelodeon pipeline, I love your transition so much.
So is Hadrian about to get slimed?
Is Hadrian about to get slimed? You know, similar. God damn it. I had a transition in mind and then you transitioned and now I can't get it out of my head and I can't talk about content. So I'm just going to say it. Similar to the way that Korra was almost canceled, Rockio almost didn't get to finish this series underneath the same publisher. So, as such, we'll talk about that eventually. I guess we haven't spoken about that yet, but he literally published the sixth book under a different publisher, of whom was the old publisher that he worked for that was willing to publish and let him finish the series. The sixth book is when most people picked up the first.
I feel like,
and then it
that
blew
first
up
publisher's got to feel dumb.
Well, they picked it back up and they paid Bane the rights to do so and the money to do so. And so they gave him back the contract, republished. It's a crazy fucking story and incredible on a bunch of fronts, including
probably like financially better for Rockio all around in the long run. To like
almost
lose
certainly.
It and then get it back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But a crazy test of faith in a lot of ways. So, you know, very, very intriguing. That said, that was my transition. I couldn't get it out of my fucking head. So I had to say it out loud.
Yep.
But we get into this very crazy fight with this inhuman creature. It's a great little one-on-one scene. It feels very horror-y. It's mechanical. It feels, again, we've been talking about like aliens and all these other things. It almost feels like Saturday morning cartoon monster out of like
also
X-Men
like
or something like that.
The description of the legs and the knees and the way how this creature is and this like dark adamantine, as we learn, like armor to it. It is almost described as a xenomorph.
Yeah. Yeah.
In many ways, like this elongated form until we learn what it is. But like legitimately feels like Queen Xenomorph from Aliens, you know, and I think I love that, you know. So,
yeah, it's such a cool and interesting description. Really horrifying,
except for the third arm. The third arm's different, but there's no tail. So maybe that's the tail of the Xenomorph, you know?
That's fair. The third arm is a little different. In my mind, I see like Dr. Sinister or Mr. Sinister's lab out of X-Men, right?
Ooh,
and like
yeah.
him tinkering with things in a very similar way too. So I just love this visual. And then he finally injures the thing and we hear it speak. And I reading it on page, it's like, motherfucker. Like, it's the twist don't expect.
Yeah.
Of course, it's also a fucking Cielsyn.
Shocked to see how much consciousness to itself. This isn't the body of a Cielsyn created. This is a Cielsyn who went to become more and was failed.
Mm-hmm.
Became a failure, but the Cielsyn that was there is still there. Like, this is still its own consciousness.
Yeah, a living failure.
Yeah, this isn't a Cielsyn Psalm hybrid thing.
Mm-hmm.
This is a Cielsyn who they tried to make crazy style.
Mm-hmm.
Yukajim. Yeah. Mm-hmm. this got me. I was sitting on the couch and this got me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there are obviously a couple of reasons to read the story. One, it sets up a couple of things. Two, it's referenced pretty directly in the third book a couple of times. And I was like, this short story exists. We're going to read it. I don't know why we wouldn't. But yeah, it's just a good one on the whole. And this reveal is excellent. He kills this one here, but not before that Cielsyn reveals that the White Hand is coming for him as this sort of like bigger force rallying. Meanwhile, the Minos Doctor, of course, escapes out the mental lock, as we kind of learned, you'd talked about, presumptively through a relay. And we end with this impression that this war just got a whole fucking lot worse.
Yeah, this is so interesting. It's like, it's such a fucking cool short story because there's not a lot of resolution here, but there's a lot of reveal. And it all feels like stuff that heavily affects where we're going. Mm-hmm. Like, it crazy to take like 40 pages to like really reset the entire universe and like what we're concerned about and what's going on. Like, you introduce the Minos, you introduce like these relay fucking extras, these exalted that exist kind of without bodies. You introduce the fact that the Cielsyn themselves are becoming extra Solarians, like, or extra Cielsyns, or Cielsarians. Exactly. Like, I still like Cielted.
That's pretty good. That's pretty good. Yeah.
We're introducing some Cielted. Like, it's like if we're keeping on the fact that this is just Halo, but real good. if the Cielsyn were the elites, now they're the fucking hunters. You know, like, they're big, they're armored, they're scary. We got some boss fight Cielsyns up in here, even beyond what we've already dealt with, like Prince Arenata. And then, speaking of Prince Arenata, we got like, hey, you thought Prince Arenata was bad? Wait till you meet the White Hand.
Mm-hmm.
It's so ominous and it's so teasery, and it sets up the next part of this series so well. And I will be very confused if we don't dive into all of this in the next book or two. But holy shit, yeah, it's such a good setup. I would like to take one moment to talk about what I thought was going to happen multiple times throughout it.
Sure. Yeah.
And this is going to sound funny, but legitimately, I know you were like, yeah, we're going to read this. And I was like, all right. Didn't think about this until I was reading it. But while I was reading it multiple times, the thought popped up. I was like, motherfucker, don't tell me. And I can't tell you why I was so convinced this was happening. Again, not a joke. I thought whenever Hadrian rolled over Assam, like multiple times it happens, kind of, where there's like a reveal of a face. It's like, is it Dimitri? Or they're like, here's the captain. And I was like, Dimitri's going to be the captain. Dimitri wasn't the captain. Whenever the thing came out of the tube, the failure, and it described it, and it was this big hulking thing with these weird arms, I was like, Salt is my boy, what have they done to you? Legitimately, like, not even joking, thought maybe we were just gonna find out, because the like what we learned is they're like collecting people flying in fugue. And I was like, Salt is my boy. No, it was a Cielsyn. But like, the relief I felt when I just found out that the Cielsyn won the war because now they have robot parts is huge, because I thought my boy got tubed again. I don't know why my brain was like, I bet Saltus is in this tube right now, but I thought it was.
that's pretty funny. I do understand sort of the instinct to go that direction, right?
Like, yeah, obviously, it's a reveal. Where are we?
yeah. In addition, like, I threw this in at the last second, which could be like, oh, it's because you're interested in all this stuff. Like, maybe we should read the Demons of
Josh really likes Saltus. Maybe we read that one weird short story that wasn't good enough to even get an audiobook. And we just be like,
none of the short stories of audiobooks, reads. That's part of the reason that this release of Songs and Sins is such a big deal, is that they'll both be read by Samuel Rukin. So
they'll both be read by me, but in this voice.
Mox Topple is living fellows. Polino and crew find a total of roughly 7,400 remaining soldiers in full unmolested.
I'm gonna.
Would that be good? Would that be good for anybody?
Right now,
please just end it there. The actual episode.
but it's a good ending. I mean, on the whole, it's not too crazy. It's a very reserved but like well done short story.
I love
in 40
the
pages.
Like
it's
suspense
perfect.
Of it. It sets it up so fucking well. Like it gives me the way how Howling Dark ended was. Really, really, really good. And it ended in a way where it's like, yeah, I'm down to jump into this next book because this was so good. But it didn't end in a way where I was like, I gotta know what happened. Like, it's not a cliffhanger. This adds a cliffhanger to Howling Dark with how good Howling Dark was. And I think that it's like a choose your own cliffhanger adventure. You know, you're like, hey, do you want to just like end? And now you're like curious to read the next book and we kind of start from scratch, or do you want like a cliffhanger that brings you into the next one? And those are your two options between like this short story and the other.
I'll also say one thing that this does as well is tells us that Hadrian has already met the Emperor, right? That Hadrian has already been there and he's got this new ship and he's got this new force. He's got the horse, which is his, you know, like this is his force. This is his red company.
The horse is crazy.
Crazy style. But like just this idea of like, you know, each book so far has had a time skip, and big spoiler here, the next one does too. But these stories fill in some of that time skip to give us the idea of like what was going on and kind of get an idea for like the types of things that were happening.
I love that we read this before the next book, because I feel like we're going to introduce this next book with a very different Hadrian. Like, if this is anything to go off of, I already feel like this is a very different Hadrian. It's still Hadrian. Like, it's not like an abandonment of the character, but like this character has changed and grown in a pretty tremendous way.
I actually, hang on, give me 1 second here. You're totally right. He has changed. This made me think of something, and I forgot that I actually have a way to look this up. So,
yes. Crossland is now getting up, pulling a book from his bookshelf.
So,
he's sitting back down at the chair. He's telling me so, while he flips through the pages. This is for our listeners who can't see the video, and they need to know that Crossland is currently looking through
the last
pages.
Two books.
He's now telling me about the last two books and how they have
a timeline in them.
A timeline within them.
And so I was like, okay, wait, this might actually have what we want in it. Okay. I didn't know this until right now. This is important, and I was thinking about it all day, variously. But the Queen of Mid-Ashes actually takes place before this story. So we've
officially read something a little bit. That's a red
company story. I wasn't 100% certain. I wasn't 100% certain. But because I was like, wait, Queen of Mid-Ashes, and I think I said this in the last episode, is like, Queen of Mid-Ashes is the first adventure of the Red Company. And this is... Well, the first after adventure, that. Yeah, after Howling Dark. And this is after that, because I was like, wait, this is definitely, yeah.
Yeah.
So, it doesn't make a crazy difference. Again, you're getting your story out of chronological order, kind of like you wanted, as you mentioned earlier.
That's
so,
what
hey,
I asked for.
There you go.
Yeah. Crossland is now putting the book down on what I assume is a side table, maybe a coffee table.
It's actually
now threatening to murder me.
It's a potato box.
Crossland's now telling me that it's a potato box. He's laughing now. He seems upset.
and with that, anything else you want to say about the short story?
It's good.
It's good. Cool. Yeah.
No, I really liked it. I thought it brought a lot of suspense to the story moving forward. Mm-hmm. I think it is actually like an incredible little moment of like kind of reframing where we are in the story. I assume mm-hmm. the story will reframe itself again multiple times based on how the story has been up to this point, but it really does kind of take us out of Howling Dark into the story moving forward in a cool way. And goddamn, the introduction of Minos and like this kind of idea of like a conglomerate of Karns mm-hmm. is fucking awful. And the idea of extra or like exalted Cielsin, Cielted, mm-hmm. if you will, is not right. good.
Definitely bad for us on the whole.
Yeah. Exelkin?
Yeah. Exelkin? That's interesting.
Is Exelkin or Cielted better?
I'm not sure on either, frankly, but you know.
Crossland is now reading pages and pretending to respond to me.
I am not pretending to respond.
He's doing his best, and it's all just pre-recorded answers. You have to know, how dare I? But he still hasn't stopped looking for a specific time event.
Okay, motherfucker. I was double-checking to make sure that I could say that you're free to read the rest of the short story collection because nothing else is out of order.
That I was still okay. Is it? Okay, sorry, I'll stop. I'll fucking stop before you kill me through the screen.
Yeah. Good.
So how much am I free to read? What can I read? What can I not?
You're good to read the rest of this collection if you want.
The Tales of the Sun Eater? Okay.
Yep. Yeah, technically the only other one that's in sort of like a chronological sequence with the stories here that's kind of important. Not important. None of this is important. Especially in this first collection, but specifically the Night Captain takes place within the Tamerlane at a certain point. So
okay,
but not
and then
not
Queen Amid Ashes
relevant.
Though that's mm-hmm. a novella with an audiobook, right?
Okay. Yep, yeah. So that is ultimately going to be our next episode. Is talking about Queen Amid Ashes. It's like 114 pages or something like that. 120.
I can never
pretty
do
quick
that.
Breezy read. Three and a half hour audiobook.
Yeah.
Excited. It's a quick read. It's that first adventure of the Red Company, you know, post the Emperor and everything else. So a very fun little read. I'm already a ways back into that one. And I remember in our first episode, I very briefly with Aaron hated on it a little bit, only because it is the one that it's not my favorite of the three novellas, but it's still way better than even I remembered it being. So,
okay.
I don't know where that came from fully. I was like kind of hating on it in my memory. And now I feel bad.
Hey, I've mentioned this so many times on the podcast. We don't read in a vacuum. Sometimes we're just in mm-hmm. a bad mood.
Yeah. The first time I was reading it, I was traveling. That's the only thing that I can think of. But
I'm like not positive I wouldn't have liked The Blade itself the first time I read it if I wasn't trying to find a reason not to like it because everyone told me to read it.
Right. Super fair.
You know, hey, who's to say?
There we go.
But the second time I was like, hell yeah, this book rocks.
Hell yeah. I will say the next story that's in this collection, Victim of Changes, is that one that I was talking about with sort of the Chantry judging the robot. Very fun little story. Highly recommend it. It's about 20 pages, I think, or something like that.
Is in it?
I'm not. Why would I tell you that? And B, no. But
yeah, and B, also just absolutely not.
And here I am telling you. But yeah. So again, next week we're going to be reading Queen Amid Ashes. For anyone listening to this as well, the schedule is up to date on the website through the end of Demon in White, with maybe one or two pit stops that aren't accounted for along the way.
I think I can pretty much guarantee you that's going to stay exactly the way it is with no changes. 100%. Or Crossland owes you $50.
Nearly. Also, we're not agreeing to $50. Like I said,
about
$50. There's going to be at least two things that aren't on there yet that we're going to have, which includes talking with Evan Likem about Angie Kills King and Angie's Shadow, the second book a little bit. And then we also are going to be discussing Musashi, of course.
Yes. Which I have not started, but I am going to.
Which I don't know if we announced this publicly yet, but I can say it now. We will be having that Musashi episode. Will include PJ. So it will be
a three-piece. You did actually mention that in our long, long drunken episode, I think.
Did I?
Well, you mentioned that PJ read it, not necessarily that he was joining.
Yeah. Well, he's joining. So there we go.
Yeah. Hell yeah. All right.
Yeah, that's official. That said, Demon in White's going to take us from June until September. So buckle the fuck up. It's the second biggest book in the series. So
I go to Renfrew all the time. I got so many buckles. Let's go.
Cool. All right. Well, with that, folks, we will see you next week. Thank you for listening to this week's podcast. You can find us on social media, Words of Whiskey Pod on Instagram, Blue Sky, and Threads. If you'd like to reach out to us directly, you can do so by shooting us an email, wordsandwhiskeyshow@gmail.com. We really appreciate y'all that do.
Yeah. Beyond that, if you'd like to support what we do here, check us out on Patreon at patreon.com/wordsandwhiskey. We've got a bunch of bonus content over there. Devil's Cuts. Why can't I think of that right now? Yeah, our Devil's Cuts, which are just like little episodes where we talk about anything from movies and music and books, so am I. To just us yapping about stuff. We also have a bunch of other bonus content, and I think it's really cool, and you should check it out. And I'm not even going to make fun of Crossland on this one.
Yay! With that, you can also leave us a review. Do so on your platform of preference. I think I commented on this recently, but there have been a ton of new influx of reviews across all platforms. It makes a mountain of a difference, especially on the recommendation algorithms and everything else that exists out there. So if you haven't left one yet, please leave one now. We always appreciate when you do. With that, dear listener, there are endings, and this is one.
And I mean, we've got so many more endings to do for you. We've got cool. Like 1,000 endings just raring to go.
Motherfucker. Cool.
Rad.
Dope.
Bye.
Bye.